So here we go. See what's first one here. Dear Ajahn, at least it's nice they all still start with dear. So very encouraging at this time of the retreat. Dear Ajahn, thank you for a wonderful week. I have had a bit of an insight as to why we don't, as lay people, go into Nimitta or Jhana. Aha, here we go. Nimittas and jhanas are described as pie in the sky, beautiful, awesome bliss. Fine, good. But I fear who it is that I will become after having experienced jhana. Will I still love my spouse, my work, my lifestyle? Or will I need more than one jhana experience before I feel these changes? Government asks if you want, if you need more than one spouse before you feel changes. what I will be after jhana is holding me back from letting go now. Comment. Very good, because it's all about being and doing. What you do is what you be. What you be is what you do. Doobie doobie do. And that's a trouble with people. So sometimes it means letting go. And if you're a lay person and you get into a jhana, it certainly will change your life. But it only changes it for the better. You're becoming more wise, more clear, understanding more. What would you rather be? Would you rather be sort of in ignorance, delusion, and thinking all these things which you're attached to are really going to be really all that happy? Or do you want to be enlightened? Interesting, isn't it? Who actually wants to be enlightened? Put your hand up. Really? Because sometimes we think, oh yeah, that sounds really good, but when you realise the entrance fee, what you have to pay to get into Nibbana, you have to give up you. And that's a hard thing. But it doesn't matter, just you say, why we can't get it, why we don't want it. Despite your attachments, you will get jhanas eventually. Simply because the seed has always been put in there now. You've been brainwashed enough with all the marketing I've been doing this with you. And I've done a very, very hard sell for jhanas and nimittas, so it's too late now. Whether you like it or not, you're going to get these things, so you're going to go for them anyway. And a lot of times it's just nature happens, that once you start to let go, you get the idea of what meditation is, relaxation, peace, taking it easy, not doing things, not controlling, not striving, you just relax. Well, you get that idea, because you have to do that, the world is just too busy. In one sense, because the world is too busy, it just makes relaxation, taking it easy, more important. Because of the contrast of the world, we know just what happens when we stress out too much. And that's when you sort of have problems with your spouse, with your health, with everything else. It's stress. So you have to relax more. Well, you do relax more. If you're going to relax halfway, you might as well relax the whole way. As you relax more and more, you get more and more peaceful. The mind becomes more and more happy. More and more peaceful. You can't resist that happiness. So all of the ideas and views, yeah, I don't want it, I shouldn't have it, I'll have to have this and that. All those ideas, they all stop and end. So instead of about just thinking about why you shouldn't do it, it just happens. That's why, you know, we go through past the thinking mind first of all. So all your thoughts are discarded. So all your defenses are now down. It's a trick, you see. So you can't think what you're doing, you get into jhana anyway. So yeah, it is one of the problems there. Because of our attachments, we're not willing to let go. But because of those attachments, we feel a lot of pain and suffering. They're very heavy burdens. And eventually we decide, okay, let's let them go. And you do. Just like what I said about the prisoner. The prisoner inside the jail, okay, the door may be open. Should I get out? Should I not get out? I know the way out, but this is comfortable inside myself. And eventually they have to wander out. And it's so nice outside the jail. Strange, isn't it? We don't think we're in a jail. We think we're free. And that's the illusion of the world. You think you're free agents. But are you really free?
It has been scientifically tested that medication reduces your high blood pressure?
Oh, certainly yes. That's why sometimes if people have got low blood pressure, you've got to be very careful meditating. It might get so... No, certainly that happens. One of our monks many years ago, he used to have a stressful job in the Electricity Corporation. And when he became a monk, just after becoming a monk, we all went to give blood at the local Red Cross. And I was with him because they took his blood pressure. And the nurse had his records there because he gave blood before. And had the records there, something's wrong. Your blood pressure is not as high as it usually is. And then she looked at him and said, you're a monk. You haven't been meditating, have you? And that's what she said. She said, yeah, of course, I'm a Buddhist monk. I meditate all the time. But that's the reason. Go ahead. So that was a year ago. Everyone knows that you lower blood pressure by meditating. And that's why we get many referrals from doctors that come to our centre, but we don't charge them. Maybe we should actually ask for people's Medicare card when they first come to our centre. Bulk billing. But yeah, they come there because it is true, medically proven. Some of the other things are medically proven when you meditate. You get into quiet meditation, medically proven, just the immune system gets enhanced. Medically proven, your tolerance level to pain gets increased. Medically proven, you live longer. You're nice and cool. And you're so cool in meditation. It's like putting yourself in a fridge. You preserve yourself. And medically proven, you become the happiest people in the world. Ajahn, is now the time after 8 days of mindfulness training to drop seeds, questions into the mind that we would like the unconscious mind to answer or respond to? Like big questions about our lives. Yeah, those questions have already been put in there. So, they're already in there now. About sort of what's the meaning of life? You know, what you're doing with your life. Because sometimes, you know, people want to have that meaning and that direction in life. And sometimes we're so busy just dealing with the next thing we have to do that we don't have the time just to think where we're going. And then we get to 40 or 50 or 60 years of age. I wonder, where's it all gone? What have I done in my life? And of course, I think many of you know the reason why I became a monk. Because as a young man, I decided that whatever I did in my life, my career, had to fulfill two criteria. And one was actually to give me personal happiness. Personal fulfillment. I felt myself to feel good about myself. And number two was so I could give happiness to others. So you could serve society and do something. And of course, those two criteria, you want to be of service to others, make a contribution. And number two, have inner happiness. When I found Buddhism and being a monk, that was beautiful. That fitted all too. First of all, you saw those Buddhist monks that I knew as a young man, just so happy and so at ease no matter whatever happened. And number two, they were helping others. All these people come to see Ajahn Chah and going away happy afterwards. And so that actually made me think, oh, that's one of the nice ways to live one's life. If it's just for your own inner happiness, you'll never be really fulfilled. You have to make some sort of contribution to the well-being of society so that after you died, the society is a little bit of a better place. And that's what's called like making merit, making good karma. So you've actually done something. So, you know, we've built monasteries. And that's actually a nun's monastery. All these great things which we're doing. And so after, you know, I die and disappear, there'll be monasteries and other monasteries, all these nice things going on. That's actually very nice to realise that you've actually done something. And done something really long lasting. You build a house and somebody else buys it afterwards, or they knock it down to build a shopping centre. We build a monastery, that's there for centuries. That's really nice. So that gives you lots and lots of fulfilment. So in your life, make sure you're doing something useful. Not just for yourself, but for others as well. And then if you do both, you'll die a very happy person. Okay? Very good. And what have you been doing this retreat? You've been giving your own happiness, and you've been doing something very, very wonderful for the person you live with. Getting away for 9 days. Not being a problem. That's only a joke. Ajahn, you have said that evil spirits can't go near, let alone harm. Oh, evil spirits, I like these questions. Evil spirits can't go near, let alone harm people who keep their precepts. And people are in jhanas. Why is this so? Also, enlightened beings are supposed to be free from suffering. What was Ajahn Chah very sick in his last few years? I was told that he couldn't even walk. Was this true? If so, why? By the way, what happened to the Theraputai monks? Thank you for answering our questions with patience and great compassion and also clarity and humour. three sadhus. Okay, evil spirits can't go near, let alone harm people who keep their precepts. You know one of the biggest evil spirits? The bottle ghost? You all know the bottle ghost. Those who don't know the bottle ghost, this is the most dangerous ghost in the whole world. It possesses people. You've heard about people being possessed by evil spirits. Those of you that would be quiet. People are sometimes possessed by evil spirits, it's true. And those evil spirits make you do things you'd never really do in your normal state of mind. They possess you, they make you speak strange. It's not your own voice anymore. They do really strange things, they can even kill you. Many people have died because of possession by the bottle ghost. Every time you open up that bottle of whiskey or beer, the bottle ghost comes out and it possesses your mind after two or three drinks. And then you say things you'd never say in real life. You act in a really weird way. You're not your new normal self, and sometimes that bottle ghost, alcohol, can actually kill you. That's a spirit, and that's an evil spirit. How about if you keep your five precepts? That evil spirit called alcohol cannot even come near you. So that's called a bottle ghost. So if you open up the bottle ghost, you've got to be very careful. But there's other evil spirits as well. And they can't harm people who keep their precepts, and people in jhanas. Why is this so? First of all, in jhanas, you're not available because you're so still and peaceful. You're really, really out of... They say it's... that being Mara, that you're beyond Mara's control. Mara doesn't know where you've gone. In those times, you're going to the realm of the mind. And that's just a pure and beautiful realm. Nothing can harm you there. But those who keep their precepts, evil spirits can't harm you. One time, some years ago, there was a Thai lady here. And like many Thai Buddhists, that when her mother got old, she invited her mother to Perth to look after her. Because her father died a long time ago. So mother was alone. She had a few relations over in Thailand, but she decided to, let's look after my mother here in Australia. So she looked after her mother very well. But like eventually happens to each one of us, her mother started getting old and sick, and she had to go into hospital. She was in King Edward Hospital. I remember visiting her myself there once. You know, King Edward Memorial Hospital for women? Yeah. Sorry?
That's
the babies. Babies, what's it called? I thought Christmas Market was. Oh, what's that hospital in that Subiaco way? There's some. No. No, not Kyoto. Oh, wait, I'm busy with that. Nah. Hey, wasn't it King Edward?
King Edward.
Sorry?
Yeah.
It just had babies.
No.
That's right, yeah, there it is. It was right after all. My goodness, you doubted my wisdom after all these days. An evil spirit got into your mind. But anyway, she was in one of those hospitals, who cares which. And anyway, the Thai lady wanted to know whether her mother would survive or not. So there was a medium in Perth, quite a well known one. So she went to see that medium, that spirit doctor, gave her $20 and asked her to go into trance and find out whether her mother was going to survive this illness or not. She took that $20. But first of all, she had to know what hospital was it, what ward, what room to actually find her. And so, given that information, the spirit doctor went into trance. You could voluntarily go into trance and leave her body. And so she went into trance, left her body, and was unconscious for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then she came out of trance, and then just gave the $20 back to this Thai girl. I said, why? What happened? And the spirit doctor said, I don't know who your mother is, but I got to the hospital, I found the ward, I found the room, but I couldn't get close to your mum. She had a force field around her. This is actually the words. A force field around her, I couldn't penetrate it. Who is your mum? And the Thai girl said, oh, she's what's called a Mechi. She's a Thai nun. She's been a Thai nun for about 20, 30 years, keeping the 8 precepts. And this spirit doctor growled at her, why didn't you tell me that to begin with? People like me can't get close to people like that. You've just been wasting my time. Even spirit doctors, they can't get close. They saw like a force field around this being. Which is a nice description of what happens when you keep precepts like that. That the evil beings can't get close to you. I told a story once. I've already told it once, I don't mind telling it again. My first year in Thailand, in this monastery, Wat Pha Nanachat, it was a local cremation ground for all the villages around. So there was many, many cremations there we had to do. And sometimes that you stay up all night because the cremations, this was actually, those who've been up there, it's before we built the wall cremation, we used to just get some wood, put four stakes on either side, put the wood on top, put the coffin on top of that and just burn it. And of course, once it was being burnt, sort of somebody had to stay around, because as soon as the village dogs smelt of the burning, they all came around, waiting for an arm or a leg to fall off the pipe. And so we all had to do duty. So I remember being on duty all night by then, because the fellows didn't really burn very well, we had to keep, with a big stick, kicking the dogs off, and then just poking the arms back on top of the fire again. Now, it's only so, come on, you're Australian, you know barbecues, it's just... It's only your body, it's four elements, yes, that's all it is. It's great, the more that you do it, actually, the more you actually see. But one thing about I learned about funerals, because in those funerals, those cremations, you always put the body on the side in the coffin. You never put it on the back. And the reason is this, because if you do put it on the back, because of the way the heat affects the muscles, you've probably seen this. Sometimes they get it wrong, it's a twist because the wood moves and it gets on its back. And then because of the way the muscles are affected by the heat, the body sits up. And sometimes even the hand lifts up and points to somebody. It's happened before, that's really spooky. That's why they always put it on the side, just so it's always sitting up in the middle of the cremation. But anyway, because there's many cremations, there's many ghosts in that monastery. Because that's where people go, that's where they're burned. That's the last place. You talk about like cemeteries being spooky places. That place can be very spooky. So I remember one night, it was like one of those limiters having a dream. So limiters in a dream, just leaving my body and going out to see the ghosts. So I went to go and speak with all the ghosts. And as soon as I went out to speak with them, the ghosts started running away. I found one thing. In Thailand, the ghosts are afraid of monks, not the other way around. The reason is because of your ceiling, because of your number of precepts, you've got more power than they have. So in the end, I caught one of them and asked them what they wanted, and they gave me this list of all the food they wanted. Because that's what they need, the hungry ghosts. And top of the list of the food which the ghosts in Wat Nanachat wanted was Nam Khick. Chili sauce. Top of the list. But the thing is, evil spirits, they can't harm you, if you've got precepts. There is this other, and one of the, lots of monks got ghost stories. One of the other monks, he described some years ago, but he was staying in one of these monasteries with heaps and heaps of ghosts in northeast Italian. And one day, you can appreciate this story because, he'd been meditating. He'd been meditating in his hut and he got a bit tired. So he leant against the wall of his hut and put his feet out. Sometimes your feet get a bit tired, so he put his feet out and sort of closed his eyes just to relax. And he felt something literally sort of tug at his foot. He thought first of all it was like one of these heavenly beings, making sure he meditates more. But this kept on happening again and again, and he soon realized it was accompanied, when this happened, it was accompanied by a very bad smell in his hut. And he realized it was one of these ghosts who comes to play around with him. And it kept on disturbing him that much, and he couldn't get rid of it until one day he was sitting in meditation. He smelled the ghost coming. He couldn't see it, but could smell this very bad odor coming through his room. And he said, "Right,
You sit down and meditate with me, or you get out of here. He was firm. And the ghost went out, because ghosts don't lie to me. So he never came back again. That's how he got rid of the ghost. So if you do see ghosts, evil spirits, and you're a good person, you just tell them what to do. Get out of here. And ghosts have to do what you're told, because you've got more power, because of precepts. But if your precepts are not that good, then you are in big trouble. Any little chink in your armour, and your ghost can get in. So that's why, if you keep your precepts, you're okay. You know, this is because of the power of the precepts which they impart on you, especially the power they give to your mind. And those of you who have had nimittas, as you can see that, if you get into peaceful meditation and you get a nimitta coming up, that's your mind. If it's got good precepts, that's strong, bright. But if you've got some weak precepts, your nimitta will be a bit sort of dull and grey. If you see your dull and grey nimitta, keep out of the way of ghosts and evil spirits, because you are now vulnerable. Well, they can't really do too much to you. They can only make you scared, really. Anyway, so that's evil spirits. Also, a mind being is supposed to be free from suffering. Why was Ajahn Chah very sick in his last few years? Just as the Buddha said, all human beings, even Buddhas, have to experience physical suffering. But it's the mental suffering. It's abandoned by the enlightened beings. That's why sometimes I ask people, it's one of those trick questions. I ask people, did the Buddha suffer? The answer is yes. He still had a body, still had physical suffering. But no mental suffering. Because as the Buddha said, even though the body may be sick, the mind doesn't need to be sick. And this is actually the difference between an ordinary person and an enlightened being. An enlightened being just has to receive the fruits of their karma like everyone else, but even the body is sick, they're so at peace. You don't feel, or the mind doesn't feel the pain. So that's actually what the enlightened beings, they still get sick, but they are free from suffering, in the sense of free from the inner suffering. This is what happens when you learn how to let go. You learn how to let go of pain. You all know that story of the toothache, which I had years ago in Thailand. Bad toothache, late at night, couldn't get rid of it, tried everything. You know, meditating, chanting, everything, nothing worked, and I couldn't stand the toothache, couldn't go to sleep, couldn't meditate, late at night, just driving you crazy. And then you started to remember what you're supposed to do. Remember the instructions. Let go. So I did let go. I mean, really letting go. When you really let go, that toothache disappeared. Just instantaneously. Replaced by bliss. Amazing experience. Had that enormous pain, suddenly just not there anymore. You just blissed out instead. You realise then the difference between physical pain and mental pain. You let go of the, I don't want to have this pain. I want to get rid of it. Why is it happening to me? When you stop moaning, complaining, and you really let it be, it just disappears just like that. Because the biggest part of pain, 99% of it, is I don't want it. That's why when that such pain comes, you say, pain, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. I can be friends with you, pain. If you say that, and you mean it, well, sorry, don't mean it. Say, oh, my heart's open to your pain, as long as you go. This is my deal with you. I'll let you go for 10 minutes if you go, or even less than that. For 1 minute, I'll do letting go meditation as long as you disappear. But that's not really letting go. Letting go has to be completely at ease, mentally at ease with the pain. You can be. I'm not going to try and get rid of you. Even that great Christian monk, St. Lorenzo, or St. Lawrence, no matter what language you speak, he was a person who's been burnt alive. You know, like that used to happen to sort of saints in the old days. I'm very happy that as a monk, I'm not born in the 14th or 15th century. All that I've said on tape, I'm sure there's enough there to burn me many times over. But he's been burnt alive at the stake, and his last words recorded in history were, you've been burnt. Remember, like what happens when you burn something? He said, turn me over, this side's done. as if he's like a piece of toast. Turn me over this side, stand. That was his last word. Brilliant. Not only was he free from the pain to be able to say something like that, but to crack a joke like that, that's really sort of, in my book, that's one of my heroes. Because imagine what it's like being burnt at the stake there, and you're free of pain. You see all the other people all getting sort of very upset, you know, see somebody being burnt like that. It's not a pretty sight. So he wanted to cheer up the onlookers, make them feel better. He wasn't at all thinking about himself, thinking about others, and that's why it's really great.
He's the patron saint of cooks, isn't
it? St. Lorenzo?
Yeah.
Really?
He's the patron saint of cooks.
I didn't know that. Turn me over this side, but you've got cooks at the end. My goodness. That's what? So the Catholics have got a sense of humour. So that's what happened with Ajahn Chah. So he couldn't walk, he couldn't speak, but his mind was very peaceful. And you know that story, that we know this, because the story that Ajahn Yara told, that when he was looking after Ajahn Chah, happened actually many times that Ajahn Chah would stop breathing. And when he stopped breathing, the nurse would always get a bit upset and think that he's going to die. Everybody, because when Ajahn Chah was sick, the king of Thailand sort of paid for a nurse in the local hospital privately to go there on a, you know, sort of 8-hour shift. So one after the other, there was always a professional nurse there looking after him. And there was also like 2 or 3 monks who would do the other duties. Right throughout his illness. And so this one night, Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. The nurse was afraid that Ajahn Chah was going to die. He knew that one day Ajahn Chah was going to die, but he didn't want Ajahn Chah to die on his ship. But obviously, you know, somebody else's ship is okay, but not, you know, when you're responsible. So he wanted to sort of start to ventilate Ajahn Chah. And I said, no, leave him alone. He does this all the time. He's just going into the jhanas. Just meditating. But even though your body is sick, the mind is very healthy. And this was a great experiment because that nurse, you know, was very upset that they were just going to leave him like that, not breathing for, you know, hours at a time. But they decided to come to a compromise. The nurse would take blood samples every few minutes because the nurse wanted to make sure that, the male nurse, that there was enough oxygen in the blood. As long as there's enough oxygen in the blood, enough oxygen goes to the brain, no brain damage, there'd be no problem at all. So they did this amazing little experiment. That while this monk was in jhanas for this long period of time, he took blood samples every few minutes and saw that even though Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing at all, the oxygen level of the blood was remained the same, remained constant. Plenty of oxygen in there. That's where he didn't need to breathe. He was that still. Wasn't using any oxygen or hardly anything at all. Fascinating experiment. And you know, just the doctor seeing there that there was somebody not breathing for hours. That was perfectly okay. And this also showed and proved to the monks that Ajahn Chah, you know, was still meditating, even though he was unable to communicate with other people. And what happened to the Theraputai monks? It's actually not really known actually what happened to them afterwards. They seem to have sort of disappeared later on. But I know that the records, which were in the great library of Alexandria, which had, you know, some of the, it was known to be one of the repositories of knowledge in the world, that was actually destroyed and burned to the ground. I think it was by the early Christians.
By the Romans.
Okay. So that's all destroyed, so we don't know what was actually in there. It would have been great to find out what was in there.
There was a community, wasn't there a community also in Judea?
I don't know about that. There's these scenes. But the Essenes weren't the Theraputai.
Oh, okay.
Different mob. Is path and fruit always attained at the same time, or can there be some time between these two attainments? If so, how are these two experienced differently? If a person is a stream mentor from previous life, will the person know this for himself? I can answer those deep questions. Path and fruit. When we actually understand Buddhism, especially Theravada Buddhism, again, like most of the forest teachers always say, go to your experience first of all, because your experience doesn't lie. Go to your heart, and then you actually know what these teachings are. However, we do have scriptures, and we have layers of scriptures. The earliest scriptures is the
the teachings of the Buddha, as in the Pali Canon. That was developed over the years. I was telling somebody earlier that we started off with just two Pitakas, and then afterwards the Abhidharma came later. That, despite what monks might want to believe, that is pretty well established as true. The Abhidharma was not taught by the Buddha, came afterwards. And in those Abhidharma and the commentaries, they get this really strange idea that path and fruit happen almost simultaneously. That once you're in the path, I think 5 or 6 mind moments later, so in a fraction of a second, then you get the fruit. And as many monks have pointed out, you know, from Venerable Gurdwaratana to Ajahn Chah to everybody, that does not fit the suttas. It's completely against what the Buddha said. So when you enter the path to these things, it can be years until you get the fruit. So there is a time difference there. There is a time lapse. So even though that's a controversial point, basically if you look at your own experience or read the suttas, original teaching of the Buddha, there is a gap there. And how do these two experience differently? It's the only place where they really go into actually the path and the fruit is for the stream winner. And the stream winner is very clearly defined as actually entering the path of being a stream winner and actually attaining to being a stream winner. For the other ones, they're not really sort of, it's not really defined very well at all. Because when you enter the path of being a stream winner, you're said to be one of two types of people on the path of being a stream winner. You're either they call it the Dhammanusari, which is meant by following according to Dhamma, or the Sadanusari, following according to faith. And what it means is those two things, like Dhamma, your wisdom or your faith. Now, of course, you need both of those things, you know, to actually to follow along the path. You've got faith that, you know, this is the right teachings, you're going to get something out of doing this. But you've also got your experience, your understanding, your personal knowledge. So if you've done something, you get somewhere. So those two always go together. But if you're much more faith, maybe not much experience, you may not have much experience of insight or calm states of mind, you've got heaps and heaps of faith. Now what you have experienced seems to meet what the teachers say so closely that you think this must be right. And that's propelling you to actually to practice the Eightfold Path, to really take it on board. But other people, they're very doubting, they haven't got much faith, but they've got so much experience, they've actually felt these nimittas, and they've experienced maybe a jhana or two. And they've got insights are bubbling up, they're starting to see some of this. So even though their faith may not be strong, their experience is that strong that they're on the bus and they can't stop now. They've tasted enough, either through faith or through experience, that they're going to go and see non-self. They're going to get those jhanas. It's just too late to stop now. The conditioning is in there, and you won't be able to get it out. So that's the person who's on the path. There's two types. And once you're on the path, you have to experience the fruit by the end of this life. And the commentaries, sometimes the commentaries are quite funny, they've got a sense of humour as well. Because they say, well, what happens if the universe is about to end and you still haven't sort of got your fruit yet of stream winning? And they say that the universe has to stop for you. And they give this special party term of one who stops the universe ending. So it has to happen. So, you know, because of that, even the laws of physics have to wait for you. So this is actually what happens, that's the path and the fruit for stream winning. It means you've got, the momentum is there, all the conditions are there, it's just rolling on, it has to happen, it's just a matter of time. And that's actually one who's on the path of being a stream winner. Now the other question is, which many people ask, if a person is a stream winner from a previous life, will the person know this for themselves? And that's not said anywhere, but what I say, I mentioned this to someone earlier in the interviews, that if one was a stream winner in your previous life, and you come reborn in this life, then when you were a baby or a young child, you don't know you're a stream winner. You know, you don't sort of sit cross-legged in meditation and deep samadhi from the time you were 2. But you have to re-experience that attainment in this life. The cause and conditions are so strong, they'll propel you there, that you will find some means, some way to learn meditation. It'll be relearning what you learned before, so it'll be very easy.
And you will find some way of, you know, finding some Buddhist text or teacher, and it will just gel with you so quickly. Right? Yeah, that's right, that's the way I believe. And you will follow that path to where you got to before and re-experience that same attainment. It might appear in this life you're re-experiencing being a stream winner for the first time. If you get memories of your past life, you realize this is just a re-experience of something you knew before. Now you have that re-experience, you may be able to take it further. So, yes, you are, as it were, born a stream winner for the previous time, but you don't really know it consciously. Because the mind has to move in the direction to re-experience that attainment and become a stream winner again.
Do you think that works in lower experiences like jhanas?
Jhana is not so necessary, because sending a stream winner is certain. It's such a strong imprint on the mind that it has to be re-experienced. It cannot be taken away. Jhanas can be lost.
Is there any record of any monk who has died just for a few seconds, a few minutes, coming back alive again?
I mean, out of the body experience, or near death experience?
Out of the body, or even past death, clinically declared dead, but come back again after being revived by some shock waves or something like
that? Oh, there's many monks, lay people as well.
People I know have read books.
But I don't know, actually, just about monks. Because I only know a few monks. Are there any monks who've had that experience? I don't know, I don't think so. Not that I know. I'm sure there has been. This simply because, you know, monks.
This book's famous, written by a Christian doctor. His name is Raymond Moody.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Life After Life. And then he's written another book, Life Between Life.
That's right, yeah. No, that's a very, very good book. And we have copies of that, I think, in both our monastery library and the library in town. But I'm just trying to think of monks I know who've had those experiences. I can't remember actually a monk who's had a near-death experience, actually while they've been a monk. Beforehand maybe, but not while they've actually been a monk. They tend to not have accidents, perhaps because, you know, they don't have heart attacks as much as, you know, ordinary people do. Because that's usually what happens with cardiac arrest and out-of-body experiences. Yeah, I don't know if he really had. Did he really have an out of body experience? Did he say?
He reckons he was just about out. I mean,
yeah.
All I know is the, you know, the long tunnel.
Okay, but I must admit, well, it's probably the same with me with Ajahn Yana. Sometimes, because I heard those stories when he first said them, and I hear them repeated over the years, and they do sort of grow. I'm sure mine do as well. Anyway, come this next question. Dear Ajahn, to close the retreat tomorrow, can we please request one... No, I'm not going to do that. So what I said, one of the... no, I can't do that. You know that thing I got into trouble with the other day? They're asking me to get in trouble again. Dear Ajahn, in December last year, a relative passed away. 2 months ago, her sister started having dreams of her. In those dreams, the messages were all similar, that she is still in pain. Although she has died, she has to bear those pains till they are done. She died of cancer, which had spread to her main organs and was given a lot of morphine. She is a Catholic, and Mass has been offered every month by her children. Please comment on the message. 2. Is she asking her prayers to ease her journey to the next life? 3. Can a Buddhist offer prayers for her? And all her siblings are either Buddhist or Taoist. Okay. Sometimes you've got to be very careful with dreams. If they are repeated, sometimes there is something which might be really there, a being trying to contact you. And but the trouble is that if they're still experiencing pain, it is, you know, the physical body is gone. It must be that the mental pain there.
Well, it fits in with being Catholic, doesn't it? Because Catholics go to purgatory before they get to the
Okay. Yeah, purgatory. Okay, yeah. But the thing is, the pain is self-induced in that particular case. So it can be taken off, and just basically just, you know, teaching her to let go. The body's gone now. Don't identify with that body anymore. It's a mentally made pain. So that'd be the best thing, actually, to even when one feels that that being is around, actually to talk and to, you know, even give her some teachings. So that's probably what's happening there. And you can give prayers, it doesn't matter, you can give prayers to anybody. Just like, you know, you can give food, you can give a massage. It doesn't have to be a Buddhist to give a massage, you can give it to a Catholic, a And you can give it to your cat if you want to, give it a massage or give it some food. So it doesn't have to be a Buddhist. You can give like your best wishes, your chanting, your energy of your mind, your goodwill to all beings. So you can do some chanting, Buddhist prayers or whatever for her, and that's fine. Because when you're doing Buddhist chanting or Christian prayers or whatever, it's the quality of your mind which is important, not actually the words which are said, but the quality of your mind. The words are there to focus that mind, and focus that mind on things like loving kindness, goodwill, may your pain be eased or whatever. And if you focus on the meaning rather than just the words, then that message can get through. If you just chant in Pali, she probably doesn't understand Pali. So it has to be the meaning behind the words, rather than just the words themselves. So yeah, that's probably what's happening there. Next question, dear Ajahn, thank you for conducting this wonderful retreat. This has been an invaluable image and mental makeover. I feel beautiful inside and appear more beautiful outside. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's very good, because you know the old story about in Buddhism, the beauty. It's nothing to do with the skin. The beauty is your inner purity, your happiness, your precepts. And that's beauty. So this has been a beauty retreat. You have had a makeover. You call these things Ajahn Brahm's beauty parlor. And it's true, because when you really relax, all your wrinkles go. You don't need Botox anymore. Because, you know, your wrinkles have gone because you really, really relax. And number two, when you smile because of your inner happiness, you become radiant, and that's called beauty. Dear Ajahn, how does one protect oneself from negative psychic influences? Thank you. I already mentioned how you protect yourself from negative psychic influences, and that is by keeping your precepts, making your mind nice and peaceful. And if you've got good precepts and living a good life, a pure-hearted person, and the psychic influences, they cannot affect you at all. One of my disciples, that he always asked me for this holy water which I made. And holy water is, you know, quite protective. And, you know, he was going out one evening and decided to bathe in protective water, first of all. He went to this party. And in this party was one of these Chinese black magicians in Perth. Quite sort of well known and quite feared. And as soon as this man went in, this black magician, "Who are you? I can't stay in the same room with you." And he ran out. See, so even holy water is really powerful. Other beings, they can't stand being. That's what he told me anyway. I think you may have been sort of stretching the point a bit, but it's a great story. Okay, so that your precept is your strongest protection against any evil spirits. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, first of all, I ask your forgiveness for my funny Dharma creation down below. Okay. That's on the other side. I hope everybody enjoys it. The title is No Beginning, No End. I'm really, really letting go. That's why I'm feeling peace and calm. But I'm not seeing the ladies in this retreat more beautiful or ugly than they are. Which again means, in seeing the things as they truly are, hooray. I did it, I got enlightened. But somehow I realise I'm in delusion. That has not happened yet. Cause, those who get enlightened never get excited, and those who get excited never get enlightened. And this is one of the sadnesses which comes after happiness, and again happiness is about to begin. Cause sadness comes after happiness, and happiness after sadness. I'm not writing all this in my own. It seems like my own choice and will, but it is conditioned. You are the conditioner and I'm the conditioner. I'm the conditionee. And also it is not me writing this, because the whole things are just anatta, not self. There we go. When this whole process begins, I don't know. All I know is up to 91 eons of seconds before. So there's no beginning, there is no end, because I started with letting go and ending with the same. And now I know writing doesn't lead to happiness. That's why I told you in the beginning that I'm really, really letting go. I say goodbye and letting go.
Yeah, the person didn't have any choice in writing that. This question, Ajahn, you have planted so many seeds in my head, I have forgotten where you put the Dvaita Svasimali seed. Would you be so kind as to plant the story again? This time I will remember so that it can be nurtured with metta. Thank you. The Dvaita Svasimali, many of us have said it many times before, I'll just go over it in very briefly. The Dvaita Svasimali, you want to know why you keep making mistakes, why life doesn't go according to as it should, in other words, as you think it should, as you order life to be. So you want to find out who this control side of you is, so you can make yourself a more efficient and successful controller. So you can succeed at what you want to do. So you want to get yourself all right, so you're a successful controller. And the controller is like the driver of a bus. It's like trying to train a driver who always has accidents. You want to make sure they're the better driver so they don't, you know, have those accidents and mess up the car. So you want to find out what that driver is. And eventually you find out the driver of your bus, you, your controller, your doer, and you find the seat of your bus, of you, is empty. There's no one sitting in. That which does is just a process. You're an automatic pilot. There's no real pilot in there. There's no being pushing the buttons. There's no being pulling the levers. That little steering wheel of your life. When you notice that, you just go back to your seat where you normally sit and you stop complaining. When you realize there's no one to complain to, then you realize the simile of the driver that's fast. Anyway, Angulimala, even after cutting off so many fingers, ultimately became an arahat. Does that mean he is pardoned for the bad deeds done? Will not that have any effect after he is an arahat? Is he pardoned for life? Okay, this is actually the law of karma. It's interesting, what actually karma is, you've done many acts, many bad acts in the past. Because samsara is so long. In previous lives, you must have been a scallywag many, many times. Each one of you. But you've also been a wonderful person many times. So you've got this whole heap of bad karma, a whole heap of good karma there. Why is it that some karma ripens and others don't ripen? Why you experience the fruit of this karma now and not the fruit of some other karma now? And the reason is, it's almost like the idea of like resonance. Now, when there is a frequency, then things which are at that same frequency resonate. For example, you know those chandeliers. That's one of the reasons why we don't have chandeliers in our monastery, because the way we chant, they'd all break. You know, they sort of resonate with the wrong frequencies. And this is what resonance is. When there's one vibration somewhere else picks up that vibration and resonates at the same frequency. Now, if you get that idea in your head, that sometimes that your mind state resonates with an event in the past. And you can pick up that event. That's karma. At that point, the karma from the past can actually come in and drive your bus in this present moment. You have to be resonant to pick up that karma. That's why that if you're in a good mind state, if you're actually coming to a retreat, you know, if your mind is on good things, your mind is actually resonating with good karma. You're open to good karma usually, and that usually comes up. If you're in a bad mood, then you can resonate with bad karma. That's how you can get some of the bad karma coming up. The point here is that there's so much bad karma, which we have, like Angulimala had, but once he became enlightened, his mind can't resonate with that anymore. It can't pick that up anymore. So much of that bad karma is gone forever. Because his mind has lost that frequency band. And that bad karma just can't reach him anymore. So, you know, they say if you go to a hell realm, you've got your good karma can't reach you there. The frequency band is shut off for a while. But especially in enlightenment experiences, you can't really resonate with that bad karma. So much of it is cut off forever. Does that make sense? Sort of? Okay, if you resonate with that. So be a good people, and then you always get good karma resonating with you. Next question. Here you go. Do they always get enlightened? Some of them make it, but there are some in Arupa state where there is no five senses, only mind, so how can they get enlightened when they can't hear you talking about enlightenment to enlighten us?
okay, it's like, can you only become enlightened in the human realm? And the answer is no, you can get enlightened in some of the deva realms, you can actually get stages of enlightenment. One of the my favorite stories is of the lady Gopalika, I think her name was, Gopika. And that she was a devout Buddhist, very simple lady, not wealthy at all. When 2 monks came close to her village, and it was about the time to spend the rain retreat, she said, "Oh, Venerables, please stay with me. Now, stay close by, I'll look after you, I'll feed you, make sure you get alms, because I'm a devout Buddhist, I can make some merit." And so these 2 months, they stayed close to her village for the whole rain retreat, and she cooked for them, and she washed for them, so they had all the time in the world to meditate. She was that devout. And then later on, sort of, you know, many years later, when everybody died, she, because of her good karma, she got reborn in the Tusita realm. The Tarvatingsa realm, sorry, Tarvatingsa realm. One of the heavenly realms, just below the Tusita realm, as a deva, because of all of her good karma. And as a deva, you know, she got some psychic powers, and she wondered where those 2 monks were, or maybe they became enlightened. But she saw them, they were actually in the lower realm than she was in. They were in sort of the realm of the 4 great kings. Just something as Gandavas, I think, I'm not quite sure. But one of the lower realms. And she thought, "This scallywags. There I was, cooking and cleaning for them. And what they must have been really sleeping all day, not doing anything, not really practicing, because here am I didn't have time to meditate, and I've got much higher rebirth than they are." And so she went down to see those 2 scallywags, and she blasted them and said, "I looked after you and you weren't meditating, because if you were meditating, you got much higher than I've been doing, and you were monks as well, and obviously I've made more good karma than you have, you scallywag monks." And she really blasted them. And one of them, only one of them, sort of got a little bit of remorse and remembered. It's interesting, they said he regained mindfulness, sati. But not just mindfulness of the moment, but mindfulness of the teachings as well. And immediately gained a stage of enlightenment, left that world and went to another level of enlightenment. There's a case of someone becoming enlightened in that realm. As for the other monk, he was just so stubborn, just he couldn't listen to her at all. So she had to leave him down there. So some men, some women are stubborn like that, they don't listen to anybody. But that happened. So it is possible to become enlightened, or get stages of enlightenment in those realms. But if you do become enlightened in those realms, because you haven't got a body, you don't get reborn, you just suddenly disappear from one realm and you go to another realm. These are realms with no bodies, so there's no undertakers up in heaven. When you die, you just disappear. It's interesting, do you think the cats go to heaven? If you've got a special cat, when you die, will that little cat be with you up in heaven so you can pat it? If so, what does the cat eat? Does the cat have a little heavenly mouse sent up every now and again? No, the beings up in heavenly realms, they're not sort of animals. So if an animal did die, they'd become a heavenly being. No, there won't be an animal, there's no cats or dogs up in heaven. Because everywhere else, they become beings. Okay, dear Ajahn, is a baby's first cry or howl a protest of his rebirth, or is it a physiological reason, nature's reason, for him or her to expel some bad air to draw in her first gulp of Earth's oxygen to support its life? Does the doctor hold the baby upside down to give it first thump at the back to support its first breath? Especially, I can imagine why. That's like a doctor's reason. But anyway, sort of first howl of protest. You know, one of my favourite stories, and I'm going to say it now because it just answers the question. There's been 4 cases which I've heard of from very good sources of people speaking when they're born, before they're supposed to be able to speak. And one of the first cases of that was just these two people, these husband and wife couple in Perth, Australians, whose baby spoke. She had another son, 2 years of age, named Peter,
And I think the other one was James. I always get that wrong, I should remember that. The other one was James, a new baby just freshly born. And it was time for Peter, the two-year-old, to go to bed. So the parents said, "No, Peter, say goodnight to your baby brother and go upstairs." So Peter went up to the pram and said to little James, only about 2 weeks old, "Good night, James." And James said, "Good night, Peter." And the two parents stopped what they were doing. They couldn't believe what they'd heard. They thought they'd both imagined it. But this time they just stared at their two-year-old still leaning over the pram. And the two-year-old obliged by saying a second time, this time with them watching very carefully, good night, James." And little James, 2 weeks old, said, "Good night, Peter." Clearly, in an adult voice, not baby speak. And never spoke again for many months until, like, you know, it started speaking Google Gaga language. As a baby spoke. And they were so surprised about that, they came to our temple in Nolamara and said, "What's going on?" Because they thought they were going crazy. Babies aren't supposed to speak, but it did. There's another couple, a Malaysian couple in Perth, same thing happened to them. Because when I told them the story, they said, "That's strange, that happened to us. We haven't told anybody because people think we're crazy." Their baby too spoke when it was born. And there's another baby, spoke when it was born. Very famous baby, the Buddha. But the funny one was when in a hospital in the United States, the baby just came out of the womb in the hospital, midwife, doctors all standing around, and spoke. And what it said was the classic statement of when you're reborn. It said, everyone heard it, "Oh no, not again." So imagine, you have to go to school all over again. You have nappies all over again. Having this bottle stuck in your mouth all over again. Having to get married all over again. If you think you've had enough of sex in your husband, be careful, it may happen. Have all over again. My goodness. Do you want that? Go to exams all over again? Anyway, Dajan, the other day you said the birds cling better with their claws onto the branches when they are relaxed and fall asleep. How come it does not apply to us? When we are relaxed, if we're about to fall asleep, is there anything in our hands, it drops off? Okay, yeah, because you relax, you open up. But the more you relax, the more still you are. So if you're not relaxed when you go to sleep, actually you do fall off. You fall off your bed, you fall off your mat, you roll over, all over the place. So when you're really, really relaxed, you just stay still. The more relaxed, the more still you are. So actually, things drop out of your hands, for sure, but you don't drop off your bed. Have you ever fallen off your bed? It's one of the reasons why I might sleep on the floor. Very much.
I heard a story, now I'm not sure whether it's Buddhist or Hindus in the Himalayas, being put on the edge of a cliff.
Ah, yeah.
And told to meditate and not move for X amount of time as a test.
Yeah.
And of course, if they wobbled.
Yeah. That actually happened in Laos, one of the great monasteries in Laos, before the war.
So either, Kashmir or, or Tibet or...
No, this was actually in Laos. They had this one monastery, because I knew one of the monks who was there, and who did this test. The abbot would take them on a walk through the jungle all day to tire them out. You know, and the jungles are very, very hot, and even if you're like a local boy, a Laotian, it's still really, really tiring. Get sweaty, and you have to sort of go over rocks and broken, rather fallen trees. So it's very, very consuming of your energy. And he'd always make sure he came to this part of the forest, not far from the monastery, but it had these huge trees, very, very tall, they're probably all gone now. And then on top of the trees, there was these platforms. And the platform was just about the size of your sitting cushion, only made out of wood. No railings on the side, high up on the branches. There was a ladder going up there, and so he'd send the disciple up there onto that that platform. Take the ladder away, say, I'll be back tomorrow morning. And these monks have to sit up there all night. There's no way he could lay down, because there's only big enough place to sit. And if he started nodding, if he fell off, that was death. You won't survive that. It's a long way down. That's a test for some of these monks. Actually, strange, no one did fall off, but many got really good meditation. Because it's almost like forcing. It's a bit going a bit too extreme. I'm not sure, you know, that's because they were Laotian and they were monks and they were determined. I don't know if you do. Because I do remember that sometimes we used to have these all-night sitting meditations in our monasteries in Thailand. Especially if there was some big event going on, like, you know, some arms offering of the monastery. And they give sermons all night sometimes. You know, all night till 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. And some of those sermons were really, really boring. But there's always some entertainment, because at all the monks there, and the sort of the novices, and it'd all be like these little novices. And you'd always look down the end of the line, because the novices had to sit there as well, but they weren't good meditators, and they would start nodding. Now, you know that sometimes that monks and nuns are raised up on seats, that's the tradition over there. So to accommodate all these monks and novices, they'd actually make these bamboo platforms, and maybe about this high off the ground. And they weren't that wide. And so when these novices started nodding, you know, you tell the monk sitting next to you, have a look at him, he's going to go soon. There's only about a time, because you go so far. And then you go, and not only the monks were watching this, but the lay people were as well. Because they were bored with the sermon, they were just watching this, they were going to fall off. Because as soon as you fall off, the way we have our robes, not only does you fall off, but the rose fall off you as well, and expose all the private parts, and everyone starts laughing. That's the entertainment we used to have. What we used to do those days. The poor little novices, and they fall off. But so that, there was those places, but it's a bit extreme. And I don't think I was sure as we cover that. Okay, maybe the next question. Dear Ajahn, I first want to thank you, Sister Wayama, and the other three monks for all the times. Isn't Sister Wayama a silent man? You speak much more with silence than you do with words. Repeating silence. So, Sister Ajahn Wayama has taught this retreat by being quiet. I first want to thank you, Sister Wayama and the other monks, for all the times one or none of you sat meditating in the hall with us. Throughout the days and nights, contain the energy in helping to lift our meditation vibrations and our tranquility to new levels. I know it has made a big difference to my practice by making it easier for me to slow down. Secondly, I would like to share a small fantasy I've been having. Or my walking meditations. Like fantasies. Let's see what it is. I hope it's not rude. I have a special tree. It's in a very large and beautiful smooth bark eucalypt. In my mind I call it my bottom tree. And every time I walk past it and turn around, I stretch up and pat its rounded smooth bottom. Like protrusion. I know it enjoys my caress, and I inwardly smile too. If that's got a lawyer, you might be in trouble. But trees don't have lawyers, so it's okay. I tried to do it unobtrusively because it was my fantasy. But at this time, together, it's passing away. I wanted to show as I let go, I don't normally have a bottom fetish, and I can't think of a time I've ever written such words. That's very nice. Now, when you get sensitive, I've felt some of those trees, and just actually to feel their texture. Because when you get very, very calm and peaceful, you can feel so much more. And it's like electric, just feeling a tree, when you're very, very peaceful and calm. It's just like, you know, even like feeling one of the leaves of the flowers. You feel its energy in there. You can't do that when you're thinking so much or when you're tired. It's just actually playing with the energy of the mind, just seeing how bright and how sensitive your mind can become, and with it, all the other senses, like touch. So yeah, I've done those things myself before. So it's really nice to be able to do that. When tranquility gets very, very deep. It's also, it is actually very helpful having all the other monks here and Sister Ajahn Wayama, because you do get that energy from other people sitting meditation. The deeper some of the monks or the nuns get, the deeper we become. We pick up on their energies. So it's nice that we've been very fortunate to have like four monks and one nun on this retreat.
Do you feel their energies as an assistant to you in delivering the retreat?
Sometimes you do, yeah. Just sometimes a person's having a rotten time, so you feel held back. You have to push through that. It's true, because you know you have the sensitivity to other people around you. It's one of the reasons, I've mentioned this before, that some of the talks I give, that you allow me to give deep talks or you stop me giving deep talks. It really depends upon your state of mind. And you know, sometimes you really want, you know, the mind is going towards something very, very profound, but you know, you stop me from going deeper. Simply because now you're not ready for it. And it's, I notice this at all, it's completely anatta, non-self. I can't stop it, I can't do anything. And sometimes, you know, you try to give a deep talk, you know, in some places, and it just won't come out, it can't come out, because the people aren't ready for it. But on a meditation retreat, sometimes you're very still and you allow me to really give deep talks. So it's not me gives the talks, it's us give the talk. And it's actually nice thing to actually understand that.
This retreat, I think, I mean, I've heard you several retreats before. Yeah. You talk the same topic each day.
Yeah.
But the quality of your talk, for me, personally, the quality of the talks this retreat are absolutely outstanding. Yeah.
Well, it must be because you, not outstanding, but out-sitting. That very well. Okay, next question. See, that's again, it's a real struggle to get enlightened because it's so hard to let go. Yeah, we read of Buddha giving someone a teaching and he or she gets enlightened or becomes a stream mentor, pardon the expression, like magic. And it's true because I gave that simile of like walking up and down like a stream, trying to cross it, but you're just going in the wrong direction. It's not far, but you can walk up and down for miles, up and down, up and down. Alongside the stream, and all you need to do is just turn around and go perpendicular than you've ever been before. You know how to go upstream, you know how to go downstream, but you don't know how to go across streams. And that's doing something you've never done before. But once you get the hang of it, it's very simple. That's why people aren't that far from enlightenment. It's just right next to you, but you don't have to know how to cross over to there. And that's one of the problems. So this is why you have to keep on saying, let go, let go. You're trying to let go, which is not letting go. It's trying to do something. It's more controlling. Which is why sometimes it does happen. But this is a story I usually tell at the end of the retreats. It was about, I think Sister Sihe, I think her name was. She'd been a nun for 7 years. And throughout those 7 years, never once did you get any peace in her meditation. Not once. Even you were doing much better than her. But she kept trying. But after 7 years, she got frustrated and depressed. It was hopeless. She didn't want to disrobe and go back to the lay life. Because in India at that time, it was really hard for a woman. So she got a length of rope. She took it out of the forest, tied one end to a tree, tied the other one around her neck. Was about to jump off. Just before she jumped off, she let go. She became enlightened. I'm not recommending that. But what it shows, that experience, is how close she was. Even though she got no peace, she didn't know what was going on. It just needs that last bit of letting go. Because, you know, when you're about to die, you know, I'm giving up. I'm not trying anymore. That's what made her enlightened. She stopped trying. And the other story which I tell about what this is all about is the story of the donkey and the carrot. This is Nirmal Ajahn Brahm's story. In southern Europe, they used to have donkey carts. That was before Buddhism came to Europe, and this is the reason why. They used to have donkey carts, but donkeys being notoriously stubborn, the only way you can get a donkey to move, beating it doesn't work. You have to tie a stick to the cart going over the back of its head, maybe a foot in front of its head is a string dangling down, and the end of a string, a nice big juicy carrot. So, the donkey sees that carrot. It won't move for it, because it's been beaten, but it will move for that carrot. And so it moves forward to get the carrot. But because the carrot's on the end of a stick tied to the cart, the carrot moves forward as well. And even if the donkey runs, the carrot runs the same speed, because they're all attached together. And that's how they get the donkeys, especially to pull the carts. They're always going for the carrot, but the carrot always moving just a little bit too far ahead. Do you recognize that story? No, jhanas, nimittas, you're running after it, just always just a little bit too far ahead, letting go a piece, and you're almost there, but sometimes you get a nimitta coming up, you go out for it and it disappears. It's almost there, but not quite. Now, once Buddhism went to southern Europe, and the donkeys heard about Buddhism, they learned, they found out how to catch that carrot. It's easy to catch that carrot. You run like hell after it. As fast as you can, put all your effort, like what you've been doing, even though I told you not to. So they run after this carrot. Now of course, no matter how fast they run, that carrot goes at the same speed. But the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop. Going at full speed, it suddenly stops. What happens to the carrot? The carrot goes even further away. Because of momentum. But, be careful. Yeah, but don't spoil my story, you're running ahead too much. It goes even further ahead, and that's what we experience sometimes when we let go. When you let go, the thoughts seem to get worse. Or the tiredness, you let go, and Sadhguru Brahma says, go and sleep, and you think, I'm getting even more sleepy, more soft and proper. When you stop, the carrot goes further away. You've either got faith, as the Sadhguru Anusari, the one who's following on faith, they've got enough experience, go through experience. What happens? You wait. Sure, it feels it's going further away, but then it starts coming towards you. And you don't have to do anything, the main thing. You don't have to do anything at all. All you need to do is stay still. Because the carrot starts coming towards you. Now when that carrot's in its usual position, maybe 1 foot in front of you, now it's not still, it's actually coming in your direction. And all you have to do is to wait and think, carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. And the carrot comes, you have to remember to open your mouth, otherwise it doesn't go in, just bounces off your teeth. So, you have to, the door of my mouth is open to you, and you let the carrot come into you. Now this is a great simile for actually how enlightenment happens. Sometimes you chase it all your life, and then you stop, like that lady, see her, that nun, she gave up, and the carrot went further away from her, but before she jumped off the tree, it came back into her. Enlightenment comes to you. You let go. It looks like it's going further away at first. Have faith, care or let it go, don't spoil it. And then it comes closer and closer and closer, jhana after jhana after jhana, just open your mouth and it says. So don't struggle. You see the message? And the last question, we've got a cartoon on it. Okay, they've got the Mara out, this is the Mara free zone, Ajahn Brahms, Jhana, Java, the good karmic cafe. Hello, I'm not Ajahn Brahm, welcome to my cafe, sit down and relax. That's non-self. We've got a cartoon here at the bottom. You may be wondering why no one's here, but it's full of all my non-self disciples that go, here the coffee is organic and orgasmic. It's Ajahn Brahm's good karmic cafe. I have a couple of friends who say they are into Buddhism and meditation, but who take recreational drugs. I used to also, but as soon as I did my first retreat, I completely stopped as I found myself wanting to be mindful as much as possible. Not to mention the precepts regarding intoxicants.